I want to now go through two more topics that we got some basis in. One is the topic of five lenses. And I would suggest to you today that everything we talk about over the semester can be viewed with the benefit of one or more of these five lenses. And then the next thing I want to talk about is the pedagogical goals of the course, and I'll call those the four sets of competencies. And that was the back of the syllabus that I shared with you all. The first lens is classical economics. This could be called old-time religion. It has been argued that what we in law schools fail to do is teach the two most important laws. The first such law is the law of supply and demand. The second such law is the law of unintended consequences. I will endeavor in this course to talk about both of these two laws. I was able to explain to my 6.5-year-old the law of supply and demand last night, so I suspect I can explain it to all of you. If there is a lot of demand for a product and a little supply, and this was my 6.5-year-old asking my wife about her diamond ring and why was it expensive, what do prices do? They go up. What about if there's a lot of supply and little demand? What do prices do? Drop. I will draw on the board the iconic diagram. And this is going to be the quantity of the good. This is the price. When the supply curve says you get to have lots, when the demand for a good is high and supply is low, demand is high, you cannot meet it except if you have a high price. But if supply can't provide it, you can't meet it. And so if you did price here, you would get, whoops, am I doing this wrong? I flipped it, sorry. I had it right, sorry. As the price rises, you can get more supply. As the price declines, you can get more demand. The problem is the market won't do that. The market gives you an equilibrium. What a monopolist can do is artificially set price high, right, and then only deliver a certain amount of the product. And we'll talk about the impact. In the free market, there's an equilibrium between supply and demand. In theory, that's at a competitive level. If you have a monopoly who can artificially set price, the power to control prices, that will lead to fewer goods in the marketplace. And we'll talk about this later when we get back to antitrust economics. The reality, however, not all marketplaces look like the textbook supply and demand story, because according to the textbook, you're pricing at marginal cost of producing one more product, and that's where these two curves meet. Now, the price system plays two roles. It says how much do you produce and who gets what good. So let's talk about that, and let's pick a fairly random product, pens. The price system plays two roles for pens. How many pens do we produce and who gets what kind of pens? Trip. How does that work? Because Romer was really excited about this when he said, yes, prices and plays two roles. You call it production and distribution. How does that work?
So do you want me to use the pen example or just talk about it?
Stick with the pens and or just explain it, whichever is easier.
So the price of production is how much it costs to create the pen, and then the price in the marketplace is how much someone's paying for it. So in order to make a profit and be efficient, you need to have a production price that is low enough below the selling price that you can pay for transportation, pay for the store to hold the pen, and all that. So
the price system mediates between mm-hmm. these two points. How much do people want something? How much does it cost to produce it? It sends signals to both sides of the market and drives the ultimate impact. And so if prices are higher because, let's say, demand moves up, the demand curve shifts upward, prices go higher, we're like, oh, we need to produce, you know, more of this good now, even though the price is higher. My bad grass here. So that's a signal to the marketplace. Or if the supply curve shifts downward or outward, then we can produce more. And that's going to get to my next point, which is supply and demand in the classic static version is a fairly stylized version. And the truth is, this doesn't exist on a chalkboard. And the biggest change to economic thinking in the 21st century was to bring dynamic change or technological change into this story. Romer talks about the old view. What did they say about technology in the old view? Will? Remember his explanation about endogenous and exogenous?
Not clearly.
Okay, so in the old world, you would say technological change is exogenous to the economic system. Let's not worry about technology. Now, that's like not talking about the elephant in the room. Because as Romer says, that's the major star of the show. How can you not talk about it? But economists, for a very long time, said, let's look at the production of a good, iron ore or pens, and let's assume away technological change because, well, let's just say we can't control it. It just happens. And Romer and others said, wait a minute, you have to talk about technology in the story. And our second lens, so our first lens is classical economics, supply and demand. The second lens is technological change. And the economist who really introduces that to the story of economics is Joseph Schumpeter, who talks about creative destruction as the essence of the economic system. According to Schumpeter, the competition within a market, the static competition, is uninteresting. He says, no, it's competition for the market. And that is a revolutionary idea, which takes a while to get appreciated. But in today's more dynamic world, we live with so much technological change, Schumpeter is now taken for granted. For a long time, people used the same type of telephone. And so it seemed like Schumpeter was like from a foreign planet. Well, come on. We'd use the system as it is. Things work in a predictable, stable way. However, you guys have grown up. And during your lifetime, you went from your parents, some of you, I don't want to know when you guys were born because some of you may have been, but some of you, your parents rented a phone from AT&T. Then they owned their own phone. And then you've only grown up with cell phones. And some of you don't even use your phones to talk anymore. It's only to text. And some are using apps on your smartphone to communicate. Think about how many revolutions in technology that is. There was landline phones, there's cell phones with voice, and there's cell phones with data. Having business models and technologies disrupt one another. And a modern scholar, Clayton Christensen, has talked about this disruptive innovation. That's the topic of the September 11th conference. This is a major change to how we think about the economy. And it's scary when you think about a world that is Schumpeterian or featuring creative destruction or featuring disruptive innovation. We're going to talk a lot about that in this class. And one of the challenges is, when does that argument, when does that lens hold true? Because there's power and there's truth in the lens of classical economic thinking. And there's power and truth in the Schumpeterian perspective. The third perspective, and it's going to be challenging and interesting to kind of use these different ones differently, is how to think about institutions, property rights being a big time institution, and the frame I would suggest here is new institutional economics, and the patriot saint here is not Schumpeter, it's Ronald Coase. And for those of you who love podcasts and that worked for you, there's a podcast with Ronald Coase. It's the same person, Russ Roberts, talking to Ronald Coase. Blake, we should post that on Twend for people. It's a great listen. Now, Coase comes up with something called, depending on what you want to frame it, Coasean conjecture or the Coasean theorem. But it's an idea about how the market works. Some of you learned this in property law or tort law. Let me give you the short version now, and we're going to come back to it later. The first thing he says is that if you define property rights and transaction costs are low, the market can facilitate win-win trades. And what he says, and this is underappreciated by calling it a theorem, is that we need to look at the market to see what happens. We need to study institutions that might lower transaction costs, for example, and look at the real-world impact. And we as lawyers, and Coase, unlike Romer, did teach in a law school, are in the business of institutional design. When we talk about spectrum rights, and we'll talk about that a bit in this course, we're going to talk about institutional design, different types of institutions that enable different type of spectrum use. Why do we have Wi-Fi as a technology today? Was it because a great technologist invented Wi-Fi? A little bit, but mostly it's because the FCC set up an institution that allowed for unlicensed use of the spectrum. And we'll talk about that. Why do we have a Linux operating system? It's because we've got great coders contributing, yes. And we have a license as a form of governance that organizes this resource. So first key lens, classical economics, supply and demand. Second key lens, technological change and Schumpeterian perspectives, which gives us the idea of creative destruction or disruptive innovation. Third, institutions matter, new institutional economics, and the teaching of Ronald Coase. Number fourth, which is a different lesson from technology, is code as law. And here our patron saint, such as it were, would be Lawrence Lessig, who talks about the internet as built on a series of design choices that is architecture, if you will, that inherently regulates behavior. You all live in a world that is the product of design choices, whether you realize it or not. When design choices that get made, they can limit your behavior. Let me give you a choice from real world behavior. When Robert Moses built the highways to Long Island, he made sure the bridges and the tunnels couldn't allow buses on them. Do you know why he did that?
Yeah? Going to recreate in the nice suburbs.
Exactly right. That was a design choice with a major real-world impact. In the internet, there are lots of design choices that get made that can allow or disallow certain types of behavior. Whether interfaces are open is one major example, and that has major consequences that we'll talk about. The final lens, and it's only one lens, is public choice theory, which is poorly named because it sounds like the public gets to choose. But it means the opposite. It means the public doesn't choose. It means private interests who have very concrete benefits coming their way get to choose. So under public choice theory, why do we get a copyright term extension act that gives Disney a longer copyright over Mickey Mouse? Charlie?
Because Disney has the access and the funds to be able to lobby people in power.
Correct. Disney's successful in getting laws passed. A challenge to public choice theory is, can you mobilize the public to stop what gets called either interest group or rent-seeking legislation? Or can the public counteract public choice pressures? What you need to know is public choice, just like any of these lenses, is not an iron law. It's a very incomplete perspective. To that end, I suspect many people here are familiar with SOPA and PIPA. Right? I see a lot of nodding heads. What's SOPA, PIPA?
They were laws. I don't think they got passed. It was legislation a few years ago that would have done away with net neutrality.
So not exactly. And this is interesting conflation, which we'll come back to. Net neutrality is actually a totally separate issue, but this legislation was limiting how people could use the internet and potentially acting as a, making the ISPs, internet service providers, gatekeepers, to root out pirated content. But in making design choices, which is what they were seeking to do, they were going to, some said, break the internet. And the uproar over that from the so-called net roots stopped this law in its tracks. So the SOPA-PIPA story is a tale of anti-public choice. The concentrated interests did not prevail because, to use Louis Brandeis's famous term, sunlight was a great disinfectant. The public got to hear about it through internet-based mobilizing, Wikipedia, Google, and there's a public outroar, and Congress put the kibosh on the law. And we'll talk more about that. And that's public choice. So five lenses. Every single class, you will be able to put one of these lenses or more of them to work. Every single telecom policy problem you come up against, you're going to see these lenses in action. And I would guarantee to you all, it won't be limited to telecom policy. These lenses will be valuable in other areas of law and policy.